So hi everybody, my name is Maggie Mohan, I'm a hoe, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how to have mad game while volunteering in disaster relief. I'm going to go ahead and trigger warning this because disaster zones are really highly traumatic spaces, and if you've spent time in one, you've probably gotten a few stories, so if being experienced something like that is going to be problematic, take care of yourself, head to the back of the room. That's really important. And checking privilege is a really big thing that I really want to stop and do. I'm not going to be offering any commentary on the type of mad game that people who live in disaster zones have. I am not Margaret Mead. This is not an ethnography. I'm talking basically about the sexuality of people who have a safe word and those who do not. So I'm looking at the mating and dating strategies of people who get to hop on a plane to go visit, stay for the period of time of 1 month or longer, and then go home. And it's going to be a little bit different than people who the disaster is home. But there's a lot of things that are similar. And also, as an overall point, people in disaster zones have mad game. Chemical love stories. So sex is happening up in the brain, and neurotransmitters are a really big part of that story. If they happen up here, we call them neurotransmitters. If they're happening other places, we like to call them hormones, but it's the same kind of stuff. And I also wanted to really hone in the point that pleasure is the lubrication and the engine of life. It's not a hood ornament. We like to think that it's something kind of superfluous, that you have sex and that's great, and that's kind of like the extra stuff, the icing on the cake, but that life is everything else that is not sexual. And I really think that this is not the case. I also think it's really important that we stop and look at a disaster context, because we think of evolution as kind of coming to the end point, that is now. And we kind of have this paradigm of, like, the good old days of early evolution was just like it is now, but more like camping. And that's really not the case. Throughout all of history, like, there are a million ways to die every day, and there is no infrastructure to respond to it. And so life, when shit is fucked up in an acute, immediate emergency situation, we're going to be looking at a lot of similar experiences that probably early people had, because there was no 911, because there was no phone, or the number 9, or 1. So sex and disaster. We have some kind of like different lists of hormones, neurotransmitters, that you're going to experience during lust and attraction and romance. Please excuse the typos. I wrote these slides at 2 in the morning, and so there might be some out there. Let me know, and I'll give you a high five for your good attention to detail. Lust, attraction, and romance. We're going to have a lot of pheromones. Those, some of the nice, sexy smells that we project. Testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, adrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. Who here has heard of oxytocin? Everybody, oxytocin has like an entire press department totally dedicated to its role in sex. And a lot of this information is really inaccurate. We all kind of know of oxytocin as the cuddle hormone. And for a lot of people, they're like, this is the hormone that's going to bond you to the person you had sex with. And if you can't, you will run out of oxytocin if you're a slut. If you generate oxytocin, you're going to like stick to them forever. And there's like a lot of stuff happening with oxytocin. For the record, we also release oxytocin when we see the color blue. And we can all look at blue more than once. So that works out. We can see lots of colors. And then we have a lot of these disaster kind of stress hormones. And these are other things that we start to release. Cortisol, norepinephrine, adrenaline. There's a little bit of crossover there. And that's because sometimes approaching someone you want to have sex with feels like a disaster. You know, you need the same kind of thing. And all these disaster hormones are really fantastic. They give you a good, quick burst of energy. They're going to provide you with what you need. In a disaster situation without infrastructure, where you're probably relying on yourself, you need to have really quick reflexes. You need to have an incredible focus. You need to have the ability to spot a threat and respond to it. But over the long term, these chemicals start to be really toxic. They have a lot of negative effects on what they're going to do to the body and what they're going to do to the brain. And long-term stress is going to actually start to tick away at your testosterone and estrogen production. So you have kind of like these really strong countering hormones, but interestingly enough, all of these lust, attraction, and romance hormones, they do repair a lot of the damage that's going to be done by the neurotransmitters we release during stress and disaster. They're going to start to pick it up. There are a lot of health benefits. So we have our sex and bonding. We have a lot of these kind of side effects. Pain reduction during the orgasmic process. Pain will start to change, and someone after sex might notice that headache kind of went away. Antidepressant effects. The entire immune system actually starts to get a big boost. Your senses, sense of taste, sense of smell. Colors are prettier. Food tastes more delicious. Life is just so much more sensual. You get all those confidence boosts. We've seen that physical wounds will actually heal quicker because of all these good things that are happening, like the circulation of the blood and lots of other good stuff that we release. The blood pressure goes down. So when you have lower blood pressure, it's easier for blood to flow. It's easier for oxygen to get to places. A lot of wound care is basically just oxygen flow. If you don't have good circulation, it's going to be really hard to heal from any injury. Flexibility, that's prostaglandins. That's going to make all of your joints and ligaments a little bit more flexible, loose. The ability to sleep, to just like get your cookie and go to bed. All of these are some really awesome kind of experiential side effects of sex and bonding. And then long-term stress. It's going to kill your energy. You get that really quick burst from energy. We can call that kind of like when Mario gets that star. Yeah, really cool, and the music plays, and he gets to run around and knock everything out. Adrenaline's just like that, except it depletes a lot of your energy afterwards. So it'll give you a lot in a short term, but it's going to take away over the long term. Hypertension, that's when your blood pressure starts to increase. Infection, your rate of infection, your immune system is compromised. Insomnia might be a regular thing. Long-term anxiety, going into post-traumatic stress disorder, but since we're focusing on acute disaster, there's no post to it. Confusion, decision-making skills can all have problems. Metabolism and appetite, the way the cells regenerate. Just over in general, stress kind of makes people close and get kind of tight in a little ball, and then sexuality can make you kind of broaden up to the experiences of life. And there's also the bungee effect. Nothing is hotter than the fear of God. And this is based off of a study where, we can talk about who has game, right? They found women who were doing bungee cord jumping, and they had them weight pictures for attractiveness before and after. And after bungee cord jumping, everybody's beautiful. Everybody. It's just like 10, 10, 10, 11. Do you have a 12? Everyone is so sexy after the bungee cord jump. So after you've had a confrontation with mortality and you've survived, you probably want to go fuck. Like, no one wants to go to Disneyland. They want to go straight to the bedroom. So as far as, like, who has mad game, bungee cord operators. So that's a lot of the theory in this quick flash talk, but I actually want to get into some of the specifics. How do you have mad game as a disaster relief volunteer? And this is all supposing that something horrible has gone down somewhere, that there is no more infrastructure, that you're going to be kind of living on a base, and you want to get yours. So some of the volunteer culture highlights really quickly. These are going to be some differences in what you can expect socially. And party hard. Activists who are in a disaster zone are going to party hard. Drinking is a very big pastime, almost even professionally, and that's for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of calories in a drink. There's a lot of things that you need to numb, a lot of feelings that might be uncomfortable, and looking for a way to bond. A lot of times we can find common ground around a watering hole. And so that's how a lot of differences just kind of get blown past, because now is not the time to have differences necessarily. Heavy masochism. There are a lot of people who are confronting their privilege in a very, very real way, and everyone is working hard to justify that plane ticket down to a place by throwing themselves into work. And this is where a lot of gender roles start to change, because everyone wants to, like, give their best and to keep going, even in the face of injury. So this is where you see a lot of, heat stroke just slows you down. You don't stop. One experience that I had was working on a site and sledging. It was about 110 degrees. I wasn't doing so well. I kept working. And at one point, I couldn't, take care of myself anymore. I ran to the side of the work site, projectile vomited. I mean, it was red, white, and blue off the side of the work site. Finished vomiting, got a sip of water, and then picked up my sledgehammer to start working. And three of my other volunteers literally stopped. That was the hottest thing I've ever seen. You're so tough. You're so, able to work. So the ability to work is a serious asset, and there's no real masculine or feminine to that. Everyone needs to give everything they have, and that's 100%. It's not just about actual output. Some people are bigger or stronger than others. Everyone's going to be facing health issues and strength issues every day, so there seems to be kind of a calibration where it's not about how much product you produced or how much work you were able to accomplish, but whether or not you gave everything you had. And that's generally going to connect back up to masochism. Did it destroy you? Are you bleeding heavily? Are you vomiting? Good. That's really interesting. Risk-taking is another one. The best seat on any type of car or automobile is the one where you're, the first to die. So if you want to have mad game, you want to travel from place to place on the roof with no handlebars, using purely yoga. That's mad game. Everyone will be really into you. Malaria pills. Malaria is pretty much everywhere, but it's warm, and malaria pills are notoriously nutty. They've been connected to bringing out latent mental illness, weird dreams. They taste horrible. They have all kinds of weird side effects. A lot of the culture is going to be talking about malaria pills, how much they suck, and the weird dream. Discomfort all the time, filth, and serious activated pleasure comfort drives. People are always going to be kind of looking to comfort themselves and what they're experiencing. High emotions and drama. What might be considered really melodramatic in a non-disaster situation is really mundane. And there's an interesting patience that people have where someone might just completely lose it and start to cry and they don't stand out. You're not considered more or less suitable as a partner. That's just something that's going to happen to everybody at any given time. You're going to lose your shit, and the expectation is that the people around you are going to support you through losing your shit, because you're going to have your turn. It's just going to happen. Bringing specific skills. There's a lot of unskilled labor, and unskilled labor is something that can be done for displaced people inside any disaster region. So bringing specific skill set, mad game. People love it. And a lot of this is all kinds of things that we take for granted as needing. But being able to come down and, say, set up a satellite to get some internet in, highly valued. And non-traditional gender expectations in general. Grooming and beauty. I really wanted to talk about this specifically because there is no such thing. Most disaster zones are going to be off the grid, either because the grid just got destroyed or because it never got built. And when you don't have a grid, the ideas of what is sexy or appealing or an aesthetic kind of device is different. And pragmatism is always going to overshadow fashion. So that's just kind of what people are going for. So a lot of traditional things you might lean on, like brands, they're not necessarily, you're not going to have as much gain. But having clothing that's made out of something that's really helpful for a situation, mad game. Mad game. No privacy for rituals. I think a lot of times when you're looking to meet somebody, you're really used to time to yourself to pump yourself up. You're not going to have that. There is no time to pump yourself up, and you will have no privacy to debrief or anything like that. Camps where people are working as activists, your business is everybody's business. You will be filthy. Like, shower before a date. Yeah, well, there's no shower. So kind of dust yourself off a little bit. And your expectations of being pretty or well-groomed, they really don't exist the same way anymore. And also, health assessments based off of overall skin quality, not going to work the same way either, because everyone is covered in blisters and bruises and bug bites and gashes and pustules and infections and wounds and sunburns. We don't always, able to identify the source. There was someone who has had mad game, totally mad game, and a big green thing on their arm. It was kind of like jello if you poked it. The camp called it a cherise. They named it after her. It did not affect her game. Not at all. Everybody poops. Disaster zones. Boy, they're going to make you poop a lot. And this is going to be something that everyone talks about. Normally when it comes to our private functions, bodily functions, we're used to having a lot of space. And it would be considered a game killer if you have some poop problems. In a disaster situation, it's breakfast conversation. How was your bowel movement this morning? And if you want to have mad game, you can look someone dead in the eye and say, I shat solid this morning. And they will think you have a grand constitution. You will have so much game. So much game. Mental health totally is something that is going to be a very big issue in a disaster zone. And a trauma response is healthy. There's a lot of times you kind of go into a disaster context and you're going to think, I'm going to have my shit together the whole time because that's what's healthy. Healthy is smiling and having a positive attitude every day. And if you have a positive attitude every day in a disaster zone for a month, you have a chainsaw in your bag. I know it. That's not healthy. Being traumatized is your body processing the fact that there's something difficult and emotional. And so a lot of standards of being strong or stoic, those aren't game. Recognizing that you have emotions, that is game. A fight or flight complex is going to be basically almost always activated in a disaster zone. You don't have a backup. So when you hit on people, really check on how you're hitting people, hitting on people, because they'll hit you. If you pose a threat, someone really might seriously fight back. So always be aware and don't take it personal. That's just how a disaster situation is going to be. So aggressive sexual pursuits, not going to work. There's going to be the long-term chronic stress, nutritional intake, physical pain and infection is present, the malaria pills again, people being triggered from their own past emotional trauma, that's all happening. And the interesting thing is that we could say the same in a normal non-disaster situation. We know how quickly these things start to impact a human psyche. So if it's every day for a month or years, that's really going to be exaggerated. But if you know that you're a little bit cranky because you missed lunch, you might be really cranky. All of these are great ways to have game. Things that are really popular as gifts or as ways to entice a little bit of sex your way. Peanut butter, high fat snacks in general. There's peanut butter and chips down there. Things that people find as comfort foods, they really find comforting in a disaster zone. So if you've been there for a month and you haven't gotten lucky yet, if you've stowed away a jar of peanut butter, you are getting laid. It's just going to happen. Skittles, peanut butter, Nutella, cigarettes, marijuana, drinking, tabloids, oddly enough. The more absurd, the better. If you have a stack of entertaining tabloids that aren't about what's happening, like something absurd, like a terrorist plot to blow up the internet. This is something that will really entice people. These are all great diversions. The fats, oils, sugars, and sweets, when you have a lower nutritional intake, those are really, really powerful, like, powerhouse tools. A lot of people aren't worried about getting cancer, and nicotine will give you, like, the next boost from one post to another. So because people aren't thinking long-term anymore, lots of people are smoking. Getting a hold of cigarettes might be hard. Marijuana is popular all over the world, and even in a disaster situation, people like to sit down and smoke out a little bit. So having access to pleasure things or comfort foods, that's game. That is real game. But why? Why in a disaster zone or a disaster situation would having good game even be an issue? Why? Out of all the things to worry about, you know, if there is no infrastructure, things are on fire, there's cholera everywhere, and you're worried about getting laid. And that's because a lot of things happen. Aside from all those physical types of situations, pleasure can actually get someone to survive a disaster situation. There's also the groundwork for community work, being able to start negotiating again, to start practicing communication, to increase creativity, for one, to process grief, to have that catharsis, to actually sit down with somebody and share pleasure, just to sit down and share that, to kind of break down and have that vulnerability is really crucial. Physical healing, mental healing, reproduction is a possible benefit of that after a disaster. You've had mass death. You need to start having people living again. And I wanted to put it towards the bottom because most of the time when we have sex, it does not result in reproduction. When there is a stressful situation, it can be harder to reproduce. And because sexuality is not as simple as, you know, like men and women who are cisgender having sex to make babies, it is a predominantly social act. And then it is an individual act. And towards the end, it is an act that can lead to procreation. And team building, you know, like if you sleep with everybody on your team, the team, you know, sleeps together, stays together. And that was just a really quick flash talk because I wanted to put out something silly like having mad game in a disaster zone, but then also saying that there's a lot of science and nerdery and geekiness that goes into it. And that sex is not something superfluous. Sex is something that actually that we need for survival. I said earlier that it was the oil in the engine. And sometimes we can think that lubrication is just make it more slick, make things easier. If you don't put oil in your car engine and you just keep driving, very bad things happen to your car. The engine doesn't work. It will drop out. And I think we can't really study how sexuality works in a disaster zone because if you're sitting around asking people questions about it, you're kind of an asshole. There is a hierarchy of needs. People need shelter. People need food. People need medical care. And if you're kind of following people around in a disaster situation saying, well, how's your sex life? You might be part of the problem and not part of the solution, just to think about. And yet, I think it tells us so much information about why we have sex with each other, what does it mean to be sexually attractive, and how does that completely shift when your context has been flipped upside down. However you might think your sexuality is, it's not like a static plot point. It's not something that stays in one place. And if your context is completely different and you're in a situation where there's no infrastructure to rely on and you only have yourself, your sexual desires and the way you pursue sex is going to change. What you thought you might have found attractive isn't going to be the same anymore. You might have been used to being someone who was a straight person, you know, back when you were not in a disaster. And in the middle of a disaster situation, suddenly the person that you find the most attractive is the person that you're just sharing a moment with. It's like shit's not going down right now. And we both have time for this, and you're game, I'm game, let's have sex. And not necessarily with the expectation that you're going to see them again. So it does play a very, very, very different role. It does give us a lot of key insights into our sexuality and how our sexuality has evolved. and the fluidity of sexuality in general. A lot of my information is here. That's all the Maggie Mayhem stuff. I'm very pornographic. Be careful where you Google me. And for people who are looking to perhaps consider doing disaster relief, idealist.org is your best bet. That's where people are going to be posting calls, so you can look for NGOs or organizations that are not based in the United States, but actually based in disaster-impacted communities who are putting out their own individual calls for what they need. The white savior complex is really problematic. Volunteerism doesn't necessarily help anyone that it claims to. Usually that's money that's going back to the U.S., and volunteerists have no game. No game at all. So that's my quick flash talk, and I'm just going to pass it off to Ned.
Oh, welcome. I'm Ned Mayhem. You just heard from my beautiful partner, and this is part two of the Mayhem Flash Talk series. So it kind of reflects our mutual creative process to kind of come up with a general idea and, you know, riff on it in different ways and find how it all links together in the end. So it will be, you know, seemingly switching gears a little bit, but we've just heard a lot of really interesting stuff about the rules of the sexual selection game in a context you might not be as familiar with. We all know the rules and the cultural context in which we grow up, but in an environment that's not familiar to us, but perhaps more similar to the evolution. Yeah, see, he was talking about this earlier. There we go. A little bit more similar to our evolutionary environment, perhaps, can get us thinking about how the rules of the sexual selection game can change in different environments. And now, with modern technology, we can kind of change what rules we like to play under. And I think that's a really fascinating idea that I wanted to study more. So started out thinking about games generally as sexual selection criteria. In addition to the sexual selection game itself, as we think of finding a mate is a game, what are the characteristics of games that we play generally? We usually play ones that are fun and challenging. You know, I don't necessarily want to pin down an exact definition of what is and isn't a game, but these things seem to go pretty well with gaming. You can see who wins and who loses, or at least how well you've done in various metrics. They usually have a quantifiable goal or outcome, which you may or may not get, and you can all play really stylishly and not get the goal, but we usually set up what the goal is. And one of the key things is that games generally do not affect their survival. You're not playing for living or dying, or it's not so much a game as a struggle, a fight, or some more dire circumstance. And that's a way to kind of test who's faster, who's better, what are our abilities to develop, display our various skills and abilities to the rest of the people without putting our life on the line like we would in a fight or a war. But just because it doesn't affect your ability to survive, it can affect your ability to find a mate, to reproduce. So sexual selection is absolutely at play when you're performing a game, although natural selection is not so much. So if you're not selected for based on your gaming performance, you can still contribute to society even if you're not getting laid. And that's really important to a bunch of people trying to survive when you don't necessarily have enough people to gather resources. But that sounds like it's setting up a very strict hierarchy. The winners of games reproduce and the losers of games don't. But it's more complicated than that, because games can have a variety of different outcomes. You can want to fuck somebody just because they played the game. You can want to fuck them a lot because on a losing team they keep playing really hard, or they improve. You know, you can root for the underdog is something that humans love to do. So it's not just the winners of the games that are getting laid, but you're still evaluating your mates based on how they play games. And I think that's at play a lot in all sorts of different games we've created, from, you know, I have sports, pool, and video games up here. But I think it's sexual selection has already been at play in all of these. Now, there's a lot of literature about testosterone responses in competition. So here are the QR codes or some links to science papers about it. But basically, people have found that when you compete at something, you get a testosterone peak, regardless of your gender and what kind of competition it is. Whether you're playing football or chess, your testosterone level spikes right when you're competing. After the end of it, if you lose, it usually drops off again. If you win, it usually stays high and really pumped up. Some people lose and it doesn't drop. They stay kind of high, and those are the people who want a rematch. You know, the people who are like, you know, God damn it, you cheated, I want to play again. Those people still have their, you can measure a higher testosterone level. I only say testosterone in these levels because that's the only one the people who wrote these papers bothered to measure. So Maggie put a big list of all these hormones that are useful in sex and useful in stress, and testosterone, you know, is absolutely in both categories. And there are a lot of other ones that are. It's way more complicated than this hormone does this thing. They measured one important hormone in the big cocktail and saw that it responds, but there's a hormonal response to gaming. And there's a big overlap between the hormones that come up when you're competing and the hormones that come up when you want to fuck. You know, there's these cocktails that are hugely overlapping. We find lots of things sexual because a lot of the same hormones are going in our brain to tell us how to play a game and to tell us how to find a mate. Okay, so it makes sense that these things are linked up, and we absolutely do not understand how yet. But here's some literature that gives at least an idea of, you know, backing up the fact that it's linked in some complicated way. Switching gears back to the sexual selection from the gaming side, there are various ways that we filter our sex partners. And trying to find sex partners in different ways, you realize how important the filters you don't see are. The first few you apply between the general population, you know, the however many billion people in the world, and your pool of people you're trying to fuck. You know, so when you're having sex offline, there are different filters that people generally apply than looking for sex partners online. The first few filters that you apply are usually very different. Both online and offline, you filter for people who are vaguely near you, or you're possible to at least go visit them. But when you're offline, you have to go to a bar or something, you know, go to a place to meet the people. So you only get to see the people who are in the same physical space as you if you're trying to pick someone up offline. And that's a huge cut from the several million people in the Bay Area to the people who go to the same bars, libraries, and classes that I go to. Online, it's a different thing. Who goes to the same websites I go to? You know, who's cruising on Craigslist or OkCupid at the same time I am. Also a huge subset of the people in the Bay Area, a very different subset. Then within that, how do I pick the people in the bar or the people on the OkCupid who I want to go approach? In the bar, it'll be how they look, you know? And, you know, I tend to sleep with people of a broad spectrum of gender identities and presentations, but if you are, say, a straight person looking for somebody of a particular gender, in a bar you go for their gender presentation, how they look. You know, if I think I'm attracted only to women, I'm going to go approach someone at a bar who looks like a woman. Online, if I think I'm only attracted to women, I'm going to go after somebody who says they're a woman. That's gender identity. It's a very different selection process. You filter online for which keywords, how you write about yourself, how you describe your interests. Offline, you might do more things like, you know, how charming are you? You know, what topics of conversation do you do when you walk up to somebody? What's your best pickup line? They're very different online and offline filters that create for a lot of people very different pools of people to date. And, you know, this is why Match.com and stuff is saying, like, how people have, you know, all these stories, how they could never find a date, and finally they went on the internet, and it was so much easier. A lot of times it's just, you know, you'll never find a date if you don't go out much, because you have a very small group of people you ever physically see. And it's hard to find someone compatible. It's not everybody you're going to get along with well, in bed or in a relationship. So those filters and how we filter our sex partners is immensely important for who you're going to meet. So, you know, I got really interested in how can we put more control in the hands of people on how they're going to filter, you know, who they want to have sex with. So, you know, this is a lot of theory of, you know, how is this supposed to work. But by trade, I'm not a theorist. I'm an experimentalist. So I thought, how can I gather some data about these sexual selection criteria that has something to do with this idea that we select based on games? So I decided to offer sex to the winners of an online Tetris game. I figured, okay, I'm really nerdy. I like people who like video games. I want to see how it plays out. I'm really curious about people playing a video game trying to get in my pants. I picked Tetris because it's relatively easy to program. I know it's got good gameplay, even when it's built kind of crappily. And so, you know, I figured I'd make an easy Tetris game. I put it up on a few different sites, Craigslist mostly, just who's interested in sex, play this Tetris game. And had them fill out a little form, and I'll tell you all the details of my experiment and show you some of the results. So I started out with the first line, I'm a queer man looking on the internet for sex partners of all ages and genders. So that's already a big filter. The first line they read, queer, all ages and genders. And that, well, a lot of people aren't going to be interested after reading that, you know? If you look at Craigslist, like men looking for men ads, for example, which are most of them, they're looking for straight guys. You know, they want to suck the dick of a straight man, these men on the internet. Most of them identify as straight, which seems really a fetishization of masculinity and heterosexuality, which I'm immediately saying I'm not part of. So, you know, but that's a filter that I want to apply. I'm looking for partners that are compatible. That's the first filter that I'm putting in. I'm tired of trying to choose sex partners based on what they write in a Craigslist response. I'm going to try something new. Maybe that'll appeal to people who are also frustrated by the same thing, which I hypothesize is most of them. I will pick the people with the highest Tetris score for my next few sex and romance encounters. Blah, 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 a bunch of other information. Get the link, show off your Tetris skills. I let them know that I'll record all of their scores. So it's not just your top score, you know, if you play five times and double your score each time, it can be as impressive as if you played once and rocked the whole thing because you've played Tetris your whole adolescence. I want to make it clear that you don't have to already be a Tetris whiz to catch my attention. And then a bunch of information about myself, my physical characteristics, because people, you know, expect that somewhat when you're flirting on the internet. They might just, you know, hate blonde-haired, blue-eyed guys and then stop reading. I advertised it. I put two Craigslist advertisements, one in Men Seeking Men, so specifically the gay one, another one without specifying my gender right up front in the ad headline, in just general people who are looking for casual hookups. And on Craigslist, usually you search casual hookups for I'm looking for ads that are a woman looking for a man, or a man looking for a man, or a trans person looking for a man, or something. This showed up in the place where you're not filtering based on gender. I got different responses to the middle one than the left one. And I also sent the link to this Tetris game to OkCupid matches. I have an OkCupid profile. I haven't looked at it in a while, but that generally has matches that answered similarly to me on their rubric of questions, at least similarly to how I answered a few years ago when I filled it out. So, you know, that's another kind of gate. I thought it would be interesting to see how many of these people that I messaged that are in theory algorithmically similar to me would fill out this form, how they would answer my questions, and how well they'd do on the Tetris, whether any of them would want to play Tetris for sex. It didn't actually say Craigslist, but only the parts that alluded to the medium. It was more or less the same email linking to the thing. I told them, basically, I mean, you only really see people on OkCupid who are high matches, and they could also see that they were, so presumably they got that part. I did tell them that, you know, I was doing this because I'm interested in who's interested in geeky sex games, you know, so we knew it was kind of part of an experiment, but mainly it was just the main idea, like, play this Tetris if you want to. So I had a survey, I had email, age, I had, to ask people about gender, I had, you can't really read this, but there are four sliding bars back and forth. One is, I identify as male, the next one is, I identify as female. The next one says, people see me as masculine, and the last one says, people see me as feminine. And I don't think that this is particularly how gender works, but I just wanted to complicate a little bit the usual binary boxes while still not trying not to alienate people who aren't big gender theory nerds. You know, if I had a 3-page survey about your exact gender preferences, I feel like people who don't know what cisgendered means would not bother filling it out, and I was interested in how they would answer also. I did get several people say, what the hell does cisgendered mean? So just some metric that I came up with quickly, and it probably isn't the best one, but to see, you know, what kind of different gender spectrum we were getting here. And it did prove really interesting, the results of that, which I'll talk about in a moment. Then I said sex interests, a bunch of check boxes of things that I'd be down for. Well, you, do you want to fuck me in the ass, get fucked in the ass, receive oral sex, give oral sex, blah, 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 all the stuff you might want to do. I had, like, top me in kinkiness, bottom me in kinkiness, go on a date with me or have dinner, all this stuff. And I did include kissing and making out with me, which, interestingly, nobody wanted to do. Aww. Okay, and so I have just the game. It was a very simple Tetris game. Kind of crappy, but could get the job done. So in addition to the survey results I just showed you, I recorded people's IP addresses so I could tell when the same people played the game a bunch of times, even if they entered a different email address, which several people did, which also shows me the general geographical location they're in. You know, I can't find their address from their IP address, but I can find the town they live in. And the number of times they played, all of their scores, all of the numbers of lines cleared, which are two different ways to say who wins at Tetris. You can try to clear a lot of lines, or you can try to get a high score, and they aren't always the same thing. Because if you get a lot of lines at once, it's a bonus. And if you do that when it's going really fast, it's an extra bonus. So it's different. I'll talk a little bit about how to evaluate these different metrics for who wins the game. So it's not just about who wins, it's about how you play. And the referring link so I could tell which ad they responded to. So first, who responded is an age breakdown histogram. So most people were kind of 20s, a peak around my age group, which is interesting. A little bit of smattering out towards the older ages. And that is generally a good demographical breakdown for who I'm interested in having sex with, I suppose. You know, I like people of all ages, absolutely. But, you know, people would think about looking for sex on the internet, like maybe there'd be like a lot of people who are older because they don't see themselves as sexually desirable by young people offline. I don't know. People have assumptions about this. It's not, you know, this strategy for selection gave me an age breakdown that, you know, is people around my age and some over a fairly broad range. So I'd be very satisfied with this age breakdown for potential partners. Pretty good distribution around the Bay Area, mostly around where I live in Oakland. Few people a little bit further out. You can see a couple in Santa Cruz, up in Reno, even somebody. All the way out, one in Chicago, somebody from Pittsburgh, and even someone in South Korea. I don't know how they planned to get. Maybe they just wanted to show off their Tetris or something. Probably it was a proxy server there or something. Okay, so this is a graph that I thought was interesting. On the y-axis, you have your self-reported masculinity. Those bars that said, I identify as masculine, the other one that said, people perceive me as masculine. That's the y-axis. The x-axis is the femininity. So the circles are I identify as, and the diamonds are people perceive me as. And the line is if you were, you know, somewhere along the straightforward gender spectrum. So if you were completely, you know, cisgendered male, you would be all the way up in the upper left corner. And there's a dot up there. That's somebody who's like, yep, completely masculine, perceived, identify, no feminine. And then all the way in the other corner would be completely feminine, no masculine identity. People don't see me that way either. Most people are on that side of the line, meaning they're a little of both. They identify some as masculine or some as feminine, and also some as feminine. This side of the line means a little bit of neither. You know, like I'm not that masculine and I'm also not that feminine. And the fact that, A, there's a spread across the whole line this way means I'm getting a pretty good, you know, sampling of different, you know, types of genders, and the fact that there's a spread this way means that, you know, it's not either or. A single spectrum doesn't even capture the diversity of gender at all. So it's just a good reinforcement of, yeah, check boxes are stupid, and it's a lot more complicated than that. And, you know, even in my applicant pool, I shouldn't be making any assumptions about who's, you know, a cis dude and who's not. Categories are a little bit more complicated. And most people are, you know, identifying or being perceived with both masculine and feminine characteristics. A few highlight respondents that were interesting that I didn't really expect to get and haven't gotten from other Craigslist posts. Millionaire executive from the first Unix company with some very intense old school nerd cred from way back in the beginning of the internet days. A Tetris geek who met the dude who invented Tetris earlier, and he filled out the form only wanting to go on a date with me and talk about nerdy stuff. Had no interest in the sex, just thought it was awesome. I thought that was really cool. And someone who had, you know, was bragging about how they had one of the top 10 spots on a big, like, internet site that has the list of all the people who played Tetris on it. So, some interesting folks responded to the ad. That's already, you know, a win as far as selecting people who I think are cool. So how'd they do? All right, this is a histogram of the scores. You can see the top scores, it goes all the way down to zero. You know, there's not a good bell curve. There are a lot of people who got very low scores. You know, a peak around, this is in tens of thousands of points, so a peak around 2,500 points. I did the best. I'm very proud. I'm good at Tetris. It was really a good stroke for my ego. I'm going to brag about it a little bit. But this is the histogram for the other metric, not the score, but for the lines cleared. And that, except for the people who got absolutely zero, who I think didn't really play the game very well, there is a full bell curve, and it doesn't quite look the same. You can see it goes all the way on the tail end with the score plot. There's some people who are complete outliers, two or three of them out near the highest scores. The line's cleared. You know, there's a few people that higher scores, but it's more of a bell curve. Each point is one player, and their scores versus their lines cleared. Now, the reason I show this plot is both to say how awesome I am at Tetris. That'll be a theme of this talk. But to show how I can select based on different ways of playing Tetris. So, for example, this person here got a relatively high score while getting very few lines, which shows that you're taking a lot of risk-taking behavior. You know, you are probably stacking up the blocks with big holes in the side to set you up for those big four block in a row clears. And if you play that way a lot, you'll get a really high score, but it's hard to survive very long. So that risk-taking behavior can be an indicator that they're, you know, something about their character, something about whether they're sexually exciting or not. Versus more conservative players, you can see somebody who got 50 lines and only about 4,000 points. That means you almost never tried to line up a big score all at once. You know, you're just playing very conservatively and consistently for a long period of time. It shows patience. Something you can learn about somebody by quantifying your performance in games in different ways. And how many times did you play, and how high your score was. You can see I played very few times and got the highest score. Once again, I'm awesome at Tetris. I brag about this. I also, you know, made the Tetris game, so I knew how to get the highest score. So I'm not necessarily, yeah. Anyway, dubiously bragging about myself. So this is another way that you can say not only who got the highest score, but evaluate, you know, whether somebody played a bunch of times in order to really get the highest score, maybe shows persistence, and somebody who got it the first time, which shows immense skill. Different ways that you can select a potential partner based on their performance in a game, more than one metric. You can see the top scores were grouped in a certain age group. Younger people tended to do better. But up until about 30, so, you know, kind of my generation and a little bit older were the people who grew up playing Tetris, it seems like. People who picked it up later in life didn't seem to do as well, at least of the people who decided to, you know, cruise Craigslist, click on the link, fill out the form, and play the Tetris. And I don't know where on that, you know, chain we might have lost the people who are 50 and immensely good at Tetris. But, yeah, maybe it was, you know, the the gender theory, maybe it was the terrible gameplay, I don't know. So this is, on the x-axis, some metric for gender identity. So I had the masculine and the feminine identity as separate questions. I subtracted the two just to have some kind of vague metric for gender identity. You can see that this isn't an interesting graph. It doesn't tell you much. And that most of the people identified pretty masculine. The other one you couldn't see when there were a ton of dots on top of each other, so you couldn't tell as much. Most people were pretty masculine. It didn't really correlate. The people who did identify more feminine did seem to do just as well, which is, you know, you might expect otherwise, but there's a huge spread regardless of gender, which is an important thing to note. As long as I asked about it, I can tell you that it doesn't correlate. So what do people want to actually do with me? Was interesting. Oral sex was the most popular. Giving was slightly more popular than wanting to receive. People wanted to give me head, and one fewer person wanted to receive it, but oral was definitely the thing that most people were looking for. Nobody wanted to make out with me. A lot of people wanted anal and a date. Pretty solid kink representation. You know, about the third of the people who responded wanted kinky sex. Pretty close, topping and bottom. A few more people wanted to be bottoms for kinkiness. Swapping hand jobs, also important. I said manual because, you know, whatever you're rubbing, it's using your hand. And I had an option for, you know, receive vaginal sex if that's anatomically applicable. Three people said yes to that. Of those people, two of them identified very male, and neither of them identified as trans, which I thought was interesting. It's like, how we ask about people's gender, we can miss, like, a lot of what's actually going on. It's a bit more complicated than, you know, are you blank or are you not blank. How you record gender identity and record, you know, what you assume correlates between gender identity presentation and anatomy and science is something I care a lot about, and I think it's done really stupidly. So this is an indication that, you know, it's more complicated than, you know, my simple rubric, and it's definitely more complicated than two binary checkboxes. And so I found no significant correlations between which people wanted which of these sex acts and how well they did in the game or how often they played it. So people who are looking for different things generally would play Tetris unrelated to what they're interested in sex. I suppose it's not surprising. So I contacted six of the high scorers and offered to go have sex with them. One of them followed through on this. Yeah, you know, I don't have to read the whole PowerPoint. Yeah, so it's just average. So picking the best people for sex didn't particularly make any fewer of them flake. It wasn't, you know, of the people who I chose, of the best ones, the best Tetris players, the top scorers, that choosing the best did not create a better applicant pool. That wasn't a good filter to put in. However, I've told you that I've already met, like, I had a bunch of people I wanted to talk to just from putting the ad out. You know, and those people I mentioned earlier, the Tetris geek, the person in the top 10 list, the old .com millionaire, those weren't some of the six top scorers who I contacted. That was filtered based on what games they wanted to play and the fact that they liked a game that I liked. So the important part of this slide is a large percentage of the people who I had who responded to this ad I thought were cool. The people who are best at Tetris were not particularly cooler than them. So it's selecting based on which games we want to play, you know, which games we're interested in, what, you know, what we like, what our value system is, rather than how much skill we have was effective in this game, or in this, you know, experiment. And the OkCupid matches didn't respond much. So people who OkCupid thinks are compatible with me aren't into Tetris. So I think that's something I need to fundamentally look at, whether that's a good algorithm or not. It's, if you're not into playing Tetris for sex, it's not going to work. All right, so that's pretty much my whole talk. From, you know, coming back to a few points. Sorry?
How was the sex?
It was fine. It wasn't particularly awesome or terrible. That's the
block at the right.
We put things places. But yeah, I know it wasn't my first anonymous sex encounter, and you know, it wasn't my best or my worst. But the caliber of people who responded to the ad was significantly higher in terms of interest than average. So that was what I would say, you know, picking the people who are best at the game isn't necessarily the best way to choose your sex partners, but picking the people who play the same games as you possibly is. And consciously thinking about how to filter who gets interested in you, who you're flagging, who you're advertising to, and how can be a very effective thing to think about in picking how you're choosing, like, what game you're playing in the sexual selection game. You know, you can choose whether you're more in a disaster relief model or whether you're more in a who plays Tetris better model, you know, or in a normal society who's better at schmoozing, who looks best at the bar model, or who writes the best essay on OkCupid. You can choose which way you filter your partners, and you should think about it a little bit, you know, and do more experiments like the one I did. One thing I was interested in was, if I did this again, in future experiments, I'd be really interested to have games that are directly competitive. This one, you just tried to get the best score, and most people, the vast majority, I think 90% of people, had their best score the last time they played. So they played a bunch of times trying to get an impressive score, but they didn't know what an impressive score was. They just got their best and stopped. Right? If I had a leaderboard so they could say, oh, I really want to beat so-and-so out of the top spot, might have been a very different kind of gameplay. You know, it wasn't directly competitive as it was, except with their own scores. If I put people against each other, I think I would get a lot different results. So that's my crazy experiment and the results. I hope you found it interesting.
Me personally, I think, like, I reconsidered. I think that Tetris is very heteronormative and it should be more fluid. All the bricks, they're so male. Okay, so we have time for two or three questions for the mayhems. Anyone wants to volunteer asking questions? Come on.
You can also find us on the break for, like, long, in-depth conversations about neurotransmitters and Tetris. I know everyone's hungry.
Okay, but there's Yako, come on, yeah.
About the Tetris game, that's good. Why did you choose not to have a leaderboard when you were creating the Tetris? Because then you would make visible, people would see it, and you would be competing for the prize.
Pure laziness.
Okay.
I was in a bit of a hurry programming the Tetris.
But that's always a good excuse for game design.
Exactly.
Just a quick comment, not actually a question. If you if you're interested in the disaster response stuff, there's a delightful Tumblr, Stuff Expat Aid Workers Like, which gets into a lot of similar issues.
Wonderful. More questions?
So I'm curious. Have you looked into whether there's any literature, I guess, sociology or something, on the use of games for signaling desire? I mean, obviously, as you point out, gameplay is this huge thing. Presumably, there's been some scientific study of that. I was wondering if there's any high order bits from that.
I haven't dug into the sociology theory too much, so there may well be, and I would be unaware of it. But I'm fairly sure there aren't a lot of studies published with such active participation of the researchers. You know, unless Kinsey was a lot more interested in gaming than I thought.